It has been exactly 1 week since the Federal Reserve announced its long-awaited interest rate hike, the first time in 7 years that rates have exceeded the near-zero benchmark. And those low rates were put in place by former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke to soften the blow of the financial crisis. Bernanke is now a distinguished fellow at the Brookings Institution and an advisor to the investment firms PIMCO and Citadel. He joins us from Washington. Ben Bernanke, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, and I know that you don't want to comment on whether you think that the rate hike that just happened from the Fed was a good idea or a bad idea. I can understand that. Could you explain, though, why that is a problem for you to comment on something like that?
Well, suppose the person who last had your job was standing around making comments about how good a job you were doing. Alan Greenspan was very kind to me when he left and I took over from him. He stayed away from making those judgments for a while. So I'm trying to give Janet Yellen the same courtesy.
Well, about these near zero rates, and now we're not there anymore, but when you first brought them down to near zero, how long did you think that would last?
We honestly didn't know, but we thought it could be for some time. It's the nature of these things that you try to get the right setting, and then you see what happens, and then you make adjustments as you go along.
Do you think they lasted longer than you originally thought that they would?
Yeah, if you'd forced me to guess, I think that's right, yeah.
As we get into the final days here of 2015, how do you think the economy is doing?
Well, I think the U.S. economy, the domestic economy anyway, is pretty solid. We've got households in good financial shape. Jobs are being created. The housing sector is doing pretty well. So there's a lot to be happy about in terms of the forward momentum of the U.S. economy here at home. The main risk we face is that we're part of a global economy which is not doing quite so well, and it's a little bit of a race between the strength here at home and the drag from outside the borders.
Are you talking about China?
Well, China, emerging markets, but also the big industrial countries. Europe and Japan are both pretty far behind the U.S. in terms of recovery, and the U.S. right now, I mean, I know that people feel the U.S. economy is not everywhere it would like to be, but it is the envy of much of the world, and it is the main engine we have going right now for the global economy.
Is it possible, though, for the U.S. to boom the way that people want it to boom for everyone if the rest of the world is not performing as well as it could?
Well, that's my concern. I mean, we have, for example, a part of the economy which produces for export, and the manufacturing sector does a lot of exporting, for example. And if the rest of the world is slow, that's going to affect that part of our economy. That could affect other parts as well. So, you know, it is an issue. And as I said, it's a bit of a race between slowing global economy and a pretty strong U.S. domestic economy.
You've spoken about deflation in the past. Is that still a concern of yours, that the U.S. could face a deflationary spiral?
No, it's not really a concern now. I think that the Fed's policies have kept inflation well away from the deflation zone. And we're seeing actually inflation beginning to rise a bit as the labor market tightens up. So, I think that it's an important thing to keep paying attention to, but I don't see much risk of that at this juncture, no.
And what about this language that's getting a lot of traction on the campaign trail right now, that the economy is not working for the middle class, for the people who are not at the very top right now? I noticed that in Dillon, South Carolina, your hometown, the unemployment rate is still 9% there.
Yeah, it was 15% when I visited there as chairman some years ago, so there's been improvement. But that's right. The overall economy has been growing and has been recovering. The unemployment rate's down to 5%, but it's true that the people in the middle are not getting the full benefit of that, and that's a long-term trend we've seen in this country for quite a while.
How do you fix that?
Well, the first thing to say is it's not something the Fed can fix. The Fed basically can set interest rates. It can try to help the overall economy grow, but it has very little to do about the distribution of income or whether the jobs that are being created are good jobs or bad jobs. That's a much longer-term issue. There aren't simple solutions. Otherwise, we would have fixed it by now. But I think a range of things from investing more in public and private capital to education and training to better immigration policy, a whole variety of things could help our economy grow more quickly. And that, in turn, would help people in the middle of the distribution.
I want to take you back to those dark days of the financial crisis. And, of course, you are a student of the Great Depression. You write in your book that, like some people are Civil War buffs, you're a Depression buff. You've been studying this for a long, long time. And you called the financial crisis that we had the worst in human history. Why is that?
Well, I was talking about the financial part, not the – obviously, we avoided a collapse of the real economy like we saw in the 1930s. But there was nothing in the 1930s that rivaled the size and scope and global nature of the crisis we saw here in 2007 and 2009. It was a very, very serious and intense crisis.
But it was the worst financial crisis. What lessons did you take from the Depression as you tried to battle it?
Yeah, there were two basic lessons that my study of the Depression gave me. The first was one that came from Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, who wrote about this some years ago, which was, don't let the money supply collapse. Make sure that monetary policy is supporting the recovery. Make sure there's no deflation of prices. And that was something we tried to do with all the policies we employed. The other thing came from my own research and from others that it's really important that the financial system be stabilized, that you don't let it to collapse. In the United States in the 1930s, about 8,000 banks failed, most of them small, of course. But even so, credit dried up, and it was a huge blow to our economy. So we worked really hard to try to stop the crisis and to stabilize the system, and that was a really important lesson, I think.
What was the biggest obstacle you faced in trying to do that? Because it's not the most popular thing, as you write, it's not the most popular thing to go and ask Congress to stand by you as you rescue big financial institutions.
No, it certainly wasn't popular. Congress reflected a lot of people who, you know, didn't appreciate, and I understand it, they didn't appreciate that we needed to stabilize the financial system if we were going to stabilize the economy. And the financial system is kind of like the nervous system of the economy. If it shuts down, everything shuts down. So we had to do that. It was very tough, both for the political reasons you're talking about, but also because, you know, we didn't contemplate this happening. Congress didn't contemplate it. And so we really didn't have the tools we needed. And we ended up doing a lot of jerry-rigged kinds of things to, you know, to try to find the solutions as we went along.
As you did that, did you second-guess yourself? Because you were such a student of the Depression, but did you ever think maybe these lessons are not the lessons that I can apply to this current situation?
Well, the insight that I had, which was that the financial crisis and the recession that followed were basically a panic, where the fear of and loss of confidence was what really was at the center of it. And the Fed acted to try to stabilize the system and try to restore confidence. That was central to our strategy. And once it was clear to me that this is what was happening, you know, I felt that we had the right approach. And again, the main problem was dealing with the politics, coordinating with other countries, and dealing particularly with the lack of tools to do this effectively sometimes.
You were worried about the fact that the Federal Reserve as an institution could be in trouble because of whatever you did or didn't do to deal with the financial crisis.
Yes, that's certainly true. To some extent, the Fed was created to be innovative and to take actions that the Congress politically or for other reasons wouldn't want to take. And we were sort of caught between a rock and a hard place because either we did these things that were needed to stabilize the system, which were, as I said, very unpopular, or we let things collapse, in which case, obviously, the Fed would be blamed for that as well. So we decided we were just going to do the right thing. There is a lot of political backlash still. Some of it, I think, is just ideological. But again, you know, the reason you have an independent central bank is so that it'll take the right actions and you know, leave the politics to later.
And there are certainly some people, even high-ranking politicians, who would like to get rid of the Fed. What do you say to them about why that's not a good idea?
Well, there's really no alternative. I mean, every single country in the world has a central bank. The main alternative that people have suggested is going back to the gold standard. But that's – I mean, it's really – you really have to know almost nothing about history to advocate that. The gold standard, for example, was a big reason why we had the Great Depression, because countries were tied to gold. When one country went down, all the rest came down with it. So gold is not a viable monetary approach for a contemporary economy, and there really aren't any other good options. And indeed, in terms of the tasks that Congress has set for the Fed, in particular keeping inflation low and stable, you know, we did a much better job than the gold standard would have done.
Going back to the gold standard, by the way, has been advocated by presidential candidate Ted Cruz, and Senator Rand Paul has flirted with the idea.
Well, again, I don't think that's a very good idea.
You joined two Wall Street hedge funds back in April as an advisor, PIMCO and Citadel. Now, you are not the first former Fed chair to do that, but were you worried about the impression that that leaves with people that you're leaving this most important economic job and going into the private sector in that way?
Well, first of all, I'm not doing any lobbying. I don't go back. I don't seek favors. I don't try to influence regulators, anything like that. What I'm doing is just giving them my views, and I do this on a part-time basis. I give them my views about the economy, and I'm fortunate that people want to hear what I have to say about the economy. So I do that, and no, I think it's a reasonable thing to do, and it's really my profession as an economist to think about the economy and to advise people.
But lobbying would not be appropriate, you don't think?
No. No, I don't do any lobbying. I don't do any kind of influence peddling or anything like that.
I want to ask you about oil prices because they have dropped dramatically over the last year or so. And when you look at the charts, the long-term charts, you see the last time there was a major drop like that, it was right as the country was falling into the financial crisis. Are you concerned about this big drop in oil and other commodities?
Well, part of the oil decline is from supply, and I think it's a really good sign that the U.S. has become such a big energy producer. I think that's a very positive thing for our economy. But part of it does reflect a slowing global economy, particularly China, which is a very heavy user of commodities. I think that it's a long story, but China is slowing for some good reasons as well as bad reasons. The good reasons are that it's trying to shift from a very heavy industrial model to one more based on services, which uses less commodities. So I don't think it's entirely a bad thing that China is making that adjustment. It does suggest, again, that there is some slowing in the global economy. In the U.S., we remain, I think, pretty solid as long as the global headwinds don't overcome our domestic momentum.
You think China made the right moves, by the way, in dealing with its own crisis recently with halting certain stock trading and things like that?
Well, they didn't manage that all that well, and it's important to understand that the Chinese stock market is very small, very primitive relative to, other countries, and its movements don't have a lot to do with the Chinese economy, frankly.
I want to ask you one more big picture question, and that is that one of the big trends that the U.S. economy is dealing with is a move to robotics, a move to more things being done automatically without the need for humans to do these jobs. Does that concern you? Do you believe those who say that this is going to lead us into a jobless future?
Well, it's hard to know because obviously we haven't yet seen exactly where that's going to come. Historically, innovation, technological innovation, has not created joblessness. I mean, we have a 5% unemployment rate today, even though obviously we have a huge amount of automation relative to where we were 20, 30, 40 years ago. The question is more, who will displace? What kinds of jobs will displace? And where were those? What will those people do as alternatives? Historically, again, innovation has tended to displace, a lot of low-skilled workers. Now, there's a possibility that it will displace some higher skilled workers as well. And it's how that plays out across the whole income distribution will be an interesting question. I don't think it's going to cause low unemployment, but it may cause some big shifts and cause some individuals to have to retrain or rethink what they're doing.
One more question, Ben Bernanke, and that is I remember back when you first became chairman of the Fed, there was kind of a learning curve in terms of learning not to talk about things, even with your friends at parties or things like that, because any word that you spoke could be market moving. What was that like to have to sort of become somebody who has to watch everything that they say? Could you even have a glass of wine?
Well, I'm not a big wine drinker anyway, but it was quite an adjustment for me. Before I came to the Fed, I was a college professor. And, you teach a class, you raise hypothetical examples, and you ask people to speculate on different possibilities. You can't do that when you're Fed chairman. You have to watch every word. And it did take some discipline to learn how to do it. I came to the Fed wanting to be more transparent, wanting to be, communicate better. And I tried to do that. But even so, you do have to be very careful about how you phrase things and how you talk about the future.
Was it a fun job in the end as you look back on it?
Well, there were some aspects that were fun. I mean, as an economist, it was just great to have such a terrific staff and people who could provide you all the analysis that you wanted and access to all kinds of data and to foreign policymakers and the like. So lots of aspects of it were interesting. But, of course, it was a very, very difficult period with a financial crisis and then a recession. So on the whole, you know, I'm kind of happy that I'm a civilian again and don't have to make those choices anymore.
Former Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke, now a distinguished fellow with the Brookings Institution and an advisor to PIMCO and Citadel. He's also got a book out about his time at the Fed called The Courage to Act. Ben Bernanke, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.